Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All this week, WBUR is featuring a special series called This Moment in Cancer. It's about the surge of excitement and optimism that Boston cancer researchers are feeling about new therapies and technologies that are transforming the way we treat the disease. But even as medicine is advancing, cancer remains a devastating emotional and financial hardship. Take, for example, 8-year-old Madison Bergstrom. She was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia when she was just a toddler. Here's her mother, Shauna McLaughlin, from Canton.
Immediately when she was diagnosed, I had to stop working. Initially, we were in the hospital for about a month and a half, and we had outpatient treatment for the next 2 years, which forbid me to work. Initially, I was with her father, and then we had split up. So because I had to stop working, I went from having two incomes to one, and then one to zero.
So, of course, facing cancer has never, ever been easy. And it's even harder for people of color and those who already earn lower incomes. In fact, just last week, a new study from the University of Washington found that in parts of the country that are relatively poorer, cancer death rates rose almost 50% in the last 30 years, while those rates dropped by almost half in wealthier places. So why exactly is that? That's what we're going to explore here for the rest of the show. And joining us first to do so is Dr. Naomi Koh. She's a physician in hematology and oncology at Boston Medical Center. She's also a professor at Boston University's School of Medicine. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, we wanted to invite you in because of a particular professional experience you yourself have. You're at BMC now.
That's right.
But you were working at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute before that.
Yeah. So I did my medical residency in internal medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is affiliated with the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. So I had the great privilege of working with the oncologists there. They've really shaped sort of my desire to continue to want to go into oncology, and I got a chance to be shadowing their clinics and learning from them.
Mm-hmm. So the next question I'm going to ask you is not necessarily about the treatment that's given at Dana-Farber versus BMC. That's not it. But you, when we talked to you earlier this week, you were saying that it's a remarkably different experience for you as a physician. And why is that?
Absolutely. I think one of the main things, and I've told this to my friends, when I finished my last week of residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and then I went over to BMC, it was just like I'd gone to a different country. It felt like the patients there, the vast majority of them, when I rounded in the morning, didn't speak English. It felt very hard and palpably different than the training skill set I had just spent 3 years working on.
So you were dealing with a completely different patient population.
Absolutely.
and they had different challenges than you had seen with the patients at Dana-Farber?
Oh yes, and I think one of the things to describe this is sort of at the Dana-Farber and at the Brigham, a lot of the times we just assume, rightly, in fact, that the patients there have a certain education level, certain types of resources, types of social support. They have primary care physicians. They've got private insurance. So they've got a lot of those basics down. And when they get the diagnosis of cancer, that's their biggest problem. It's devastating. They're dealing with it. It's an issue. At BMC, they lack all those things I just listed. And so I was out to dinner with some friends last night who I work with, and they've spent decades, their lives at BMC, serving our patients in the cancer arena. And Donna Manning, one of our most amazing chemo nurses, said to me, "You know, Naomi, cancer's not their biggest problem. When they come to us, their cancer diagnosis is often not their biggest problem."
That is a stunning, stunning thing to hear.
Yeah.
Dr. Koh, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring in another voice to add some perspective here. Reginald Tucker Seeley, he's a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. He's also a researcher at the Center for Community-Based Research at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Reginald Tucker Seeley, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's talk about what Dr. Koh just mentioned, that there are entire patient populations, communities, where cancer is not the biggest challenge, even when they're diagnosed. I mean, what does that mean for how they confront their cancer challenge?
Yeah, so my research focuses on this concept of financial well-being. So really thinking about financial well-being across the cancer continuum, from efforts in prevention, throughout detection, diagnosis, throughout treatment, survivorship, and end-of-life care. And I think about financial well-being sort of as this construct that has three domains. That is, it's a material domain that focuses on the financial resources that people have, a psychosocial area that focuses on how people feel about those resources, and a behavioral area that focuses on sort of what people do with their financial resources. And I think sort of as we think about across the socioeconomic spectrum, sort of this concept of financial well-being is important for folks at the low end, but it's also important sort of as we move up the socioeconomic ladder. So I think that the caller that, or the example that you played earlier with the mom with the child that had cancer and she had to end work and that also influenced, you know, her marriage and also sort of impacted the amount of household income that she had available. I think we haven't quite figured out sort of how do we capture or how do we measure the financial implications of having cancer, both for people on the low end, as Naomi mentioned, but also for middle income families, but that I'd imagine that was the person that you provide the example for.
Well, just a layperson's guess here, but my guess is that the impact just scales up the more financially tenuous a patient's situation is when they're first diagnosed.
Yes. Well, and two, I mean, one thing we know from behavioral economics research is that, you know, most of us are not really good financial managers, and most of us make, you know, substantial financial missteps. But those of us with more financial resources, we have a buffer. We may have financial reserves. We may have we come from two income households. We have reserves to buffer those missteps. And so for the examples that Naomi was providing with her patient population, they may not necessarily have those buffers that sort of can help to help manage the cancer care that they're navigating.
So Dr. Ko, jump in here again. How then, as a physician, do you address these additional factors that are part of a patient's whole life when they come to you for treatment?
That's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because it's an opportunity to really say that all of us at Boston Medical Center, all of us as care providers, really strive to provide exceptional care without exception. And I think we all go to work living by that. And so when you march into work every day and that's the mosaic with which you're working on and the framework with which you're building your care plans and everything, we intuitively, and I don't, it's hard to even measure, which we're talking a lot about measurement and outcomes, but you go in and you realize when you do the social history for a patient, you're not just asking about whether they smoke, drink, or take illicit drugs. You're asking them, where do you live? Who do you live with? Who's your social support? Are you working right now?
Yeah.
And those are the questions I'm asking my patients.
Well, so let me ask both of you something here. At the top of our conversation, I read this outfinding of a new study from the University of Washington that found that in poorer parts of the United States, cancer death rates have risen by 50%, whereas in wealthier parts, they've dropped by half. Now, it's not that we're saying cancer death rates have plateaued. Mm-hmm. Well, in wealthier places, they've dropped. We're saying that in poorer places, they're rising by 50%. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'd spent part of my time doing my clinic and working with breast cancer patients to cure breast cancer. And the majority of my time, I'm actually working on breast cancer disparities. Mm. And so this sort of disparity that you're talking about is incredibly well known, particularly in the breast cancer population. So if you look at data on death rate and mortality and compare white women and black women, based on race alone, we see a huge discrepancy. This has been a problem for a long time now. And so those disparities are well defined. It is now incumbent upon us as a community, as researchers, to try and solve this.
But I think, too, one of the challenges that sort of financial hardship poses is that, you know, I think as Naomi mentioned, sort of now families are having to manage, in addition to all of the other hardships that they may have been managing before the cancer diagnosis, now in addition to that, they have to now manage cancer care. So that financial hardship sort of forces families to then, you know, sort of set us sort of either prioritize where they're spending their resources. It can cause families to either not be adherent to, you know, medication or treatment regimen or miss appointments because they're now having to manage, in addition to whatever hardships they were managing before, they have this additional hardship that they now have to manage.
Right. So do you have a concern? I mean, we're talking about this moment in cancer this week at WBUR because In the research community in Greater Boston, there is a great deal of excitement about new technologies, new therapies, new drugs that make it feel like we're maybe turning a corner in battling this disease.
Well, I think sort of one of the things that we see with any new intervention is that the likelihood of uptake with that new intervention is probably going to be sort of engaged with by people who have more resources, who have more access, and who have more knowledge that those resources are available. So what we're going to see is people on the higher end of the socioeconomic spectrum being able to take full advantage of those new advances, but people on the lower end may be less likely to have access to those.
Yeah, I mean, let me just be more blunt about it. Are you concerned that the disparity in outcome may become even wider?
Absolutely. And I think that is a big, big fear among at least people in my community and academic community is really worrying about that. We talk a lot about this moonshot for cancer and personalized medicine and personalized care. Well, the patients that are getting enrolled on those clinical trials that are getting their specimens tested and genotyped are not the patients that I'm seeing. And I think that's a big problem. And I think we need to get more of our patients and get the resources to encourage more clinical trial enrollment in our patient population.
I think, too, one of the issues is that, you know, we do focus a lot on, you know, treatments and new interventions. But then thinking about sort of how do we address the social issues that Naomi mentioned that families are struggling with? Is it the role of the healthcare institution to address those? We as a health as sort of a public health and medicine community haven't really sort of come to terms with who is going to address the issues that were likely relevant to the family even before diagnosis took place.
All the issues with the whole patient.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So, but Dr. Koh, let me ask you, when we started this conversation a couple of days ago, we had Tyler Jackson. He's the head of the Koch Institute at MIT. And he was saying that one of the great things about the Boston area is that there's this nexus of researchers that are able to talk to each other, connect with each other, compare work. I heard what you said about getting the patients that you represent into those drug trials. That ought to be possible here. I mean, is there a way to connect them with the cutting edge research that's happening?
Yeah, so we do have a cancer clinical trials office at BMC, but the amount of resources it takes to A, even have a clinical trials office is a lot. And then to have one that you're doing it right in a patient population like ours. So every consent form needs to be translated in about 20 different languages if you're going to try and recruit that type of patient. And then there's just a lot of inherent barriers to making sure that we're getting those people enrolled. And you don't want to enroll a patient on a clinical trial if they don't really understand what they're getting into, because then you're getting into a lot of bad historical memory around Tuskegee and other things where these patients don't want to be, quote, experimented on.
Right.
So for us to do it right, it just takes even more resources than if you can walk into a room with a patient at the Farber who's telling you about the phase 2 trial they just looked up on the internet and can they enroll in it here. I mean, that's what we would hear when we were at the Farber. Those are very highly educated and motivated people with agency who can do that. Mm. But our patients were like, will you please consider this?
I think, too, an issue that has to be presented is that I think oftentimes when we talk about engagement with clinical trials and sort of navigating care, we assume that people have flexible schedules. Mm-hmm. They can, you know, they can take off work anytime. They have child care. They can get to the institution. And when those things aren't present, I think those things definitely present barriers.
Yeah, and yet we all here in the Greater Boston area feel the moral obligation to be sure that all patients get treated as the research progresses. Well, Reginald Tucker Seeley, professor at Harvard's School of Public Health and researcher at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, thank you so much.
Great, thank you.
And Dr. Naomi Koh, physician in hematology and oncology at Boston Medical Center, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.